the world's oldest teenager, has died. Dick Clark became a national icon in the 1950s as the host of American Bandstand. The show continued through the late 80s, and for more than 30 years, Clark hosted the New Year's Eve special for ABC. Dick Clark died this morning after a massive heart attack. He was 82 years old. We hear more about his life from NPR's Netta Ulaby.
In 1956, producers at WFIL-TV in Philadelphia had a big problem. The host of the city's top-rated show, a local teen dance program, was accused of sexual impropriety with some of the teenage dancers. Then he was arrested for drunk driving. The station faced enormous pressure to cancel its most lucrative program. Music historian John Jackson said the show needed a new host, fast.
And at the time, there was a gentleman working on a show, a nondescript radio show, and he had a clean-cut, impeccable image. He had a boyish look about him, an innocent look, and that gentleman happened to be Dick Clark.
One of the things Dick Clark did best was make the scandalous tame. At the time, rock and roll was still sort of controversial. Clark created an image of wholesome American teen life to which bubbly pop music was fundamental. By doing so, he changed the culture.
I think Bandstand was important historically because it gave the world a look at a world perhaps they'd never looked at before. That's the world of kids.
That's Dick Clark in a 1998 NPR interview. He was one of the first to take kids seriously as consumers and use the music they liked as a marketing tool. Now, of course, that concept occupies entire TV channels. So in retrospect, John Jackson says, it's hard to imagine the reaction in 1957 when Clark proposed to ABC that Bandstand go national.
He was laughed out of the studio, and they said to him, "Who wants to watch kids dancing in Philadelphia?"
It turned out everybody did. Come on, baby. The show was an instant success and bailed out the struggling network. Richard Wagstaff Clark got his first job at an upstate New York radio station owned by his uncle and managed by his dad. But nepotism only got him so far. In Philadelphia, Clark was on his own, and he credited Bandstand's immediate success partly to its sense of place.
We were in a major city, Philadelphia. We got serviced with the latest releases, and we had a huge teen audience watching who were trendsetters. So radio station program directors used to assign their assistants to watch the program and copy down what we played, and within a day, it was being played everywhere. Tonight your mind
completely. You know, if you were on the Clark Show with a new record, it was almost like Dick Clark giving his blessings and saying this record is going to be a hit.
Clark made a teen idol out of Brenda Lee, who spoke with NPR a few years ago, as well as Fabian, Frankie Avalon, and Freddie Cannon.
Whatever record you had out on that show, I mean, you automatically sold 50, 60, 70, 100,000 records by the end of the week of that week. That's how much records it was sold off of one television show. The power of that show was so strong. Last night I took a walk after dark.
People today can't imagine how much power he had. In the 1950s, when Dick started, he was the only national disc jockey.
John Jackson wrote a history of American Bandstand. He says all that power eventually got Clark into trouble.
Nobody knew it, but he began to accumulate record companies, music publishing companies. He owned a record pressing company, and Dick would go on American Bandstand and play a record and rave about it up and down and say, here's this great new record, and nobody would know that he owned the record.
That conflict of interest became public in 1959 when a congressional investigation into payola targeted Dick Clark's business practices. Clark had to choose his music industry interests or hosting American Bandstand. Bandstand won, but John Jackson says the experience embittered Clark, and he carried on legitimate entrepreneurship with a vengeance.
He diversified. He bought things from radio stations to oil wells, and this was the early 1960s. But probably the most important thing that he did, and he had a tremendous amount of foresight, Dick put a lot of that money into producing.
Dick Clark became one of television's most powerful independent producers. He produced and hosted game shows like the $10,000 Pyramid, celebrity specials, celebrity blooper specials, and exploitation movies. One featured Dick Clark. He played a TV announcer critical of youth culture run amok.
Who in America can truly resist the clarion call of youth? Never has it been so brazenly sounded. Experience? It has brought you nothing.
That's an uncharacteristically cynical pronouncement from a man whose uncanny youthfulness was essential to his brand. A more repeated quote was this: music is the soundtrack to your life. Dick Clark died this morning in Los Angeles. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
This is NPR. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. And, hey, Melissa, yeah. You talking to me?
You can't handle the truth.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
In the annals of cinema, there are movie lines we forget, and there are movie lines that are so unforgettable, they can kick around the culture for generations.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die!
He's looking at you, kid.
Love means never having to say you're sorry.
You had me at hello.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'll have what she's having.
Now, researchers at Cornell University have created a computer program to understand what makes a memorable movie quote memorable. The system sorted through thousands of quotes that have been flagged by users on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database.
It then compared them to other lines in the same movie spoken by the same character. The difference, they found, comes down to a few factors.
The memorable lines use a combination of the present tense,
general syntax,
and indefinite articles. John Kleinberg is a computer science professor at Cornell and one of the study's co-authors.
One example is in Jaws when they say,
"You're going to need a big bigger boat."
You could ask what would have happened if that line had been, "You're going to need the bigger boat." You might well have asked yourself, which bigger boat? Was there some boat we were talking about? You're going to need a bigger boat, you could argue, makes it more freestanding and therefore more portable.
Struggling screenwriters take comfort. Kleinberg says the algorithm won't be used to produce box office hits. Think of it more as advice, he says, for writing movies, ads, even political slogans. But the computer system is not without its flaws.
When presented with two movie quotes, one considered more memorable than the other, the computer could only identify the popular one about 65% of the time. Humans, on the other hand, answered correctly at a rate of 75%, to which we say,
"Well, nobody's perfect."
Dick Clark, most famous for hosting the American Bandstand and many New Year's Eve celebrations, died yesterday in Santa Monica, California. He was 82 and had been in fragile health since suffering a major stroke in 2004. Clark's career spanned half a century and several entertainment genres, as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
If you were a teenager in the 1950s, you rushed home from school, threw your books on the kitchen table, and ran to turn on the television so you could watch American Bandstand.
And now, here he is, the star of our show, Dick Clark!
Clark didn't look much older than his teenage studio audience. His fresh face and affable persona reassured kids' parents that rock and roll was safe for mainstream America. Bill Wordy, editorial director of Billboard magazine, says in the early days, Bandstand was critical to marketing records.
This wasn't today, where there's 1,000 different channels of distribution and promotion. To have a national TV show that was sort of hitting especially teen girls at the exact moment that they were coming home from school, it was an incredibly powerful device.
Artists who were considered rock and pop royalty performed on Bandstand, but so did newcomers. Roger McGuinn, then a guitarist and singer for a now legendary folk rock band, remembers his first appearance in the 1960s.
I was a big fan of American Bandstand. I remember watching it as a teenager, and then I was honored to be on it in my early 20s when we were in the Birds.
Touchdown, you'll find that.
Clark showcased black artists, too, like Chuck Berry, Sam Cooke, and the Supremes. He understood that white kids listened to black music. In 1998, Clark told radio show Rock and Roll America that when Bandstand started in Philadelphia, the audience was segregated. He knew, though, that things had to change when the show moved to Los Angeles.
He said, you know, the world is becoming a little more integrated. We better start getting some Negroes in the program.
Scripps College professor Matt Delmont has just published The Nicest Kids in Town, a history of how Bandstand resisted integration for years. When it finally happened, Delmont said, the big motivator was a successful competitor.
Clark definitely saw Soul Train and Don Cornelius as a threat, to the extent that he started his own rival television show, what he called a black version of Bandstand called Soul Unlimited, that was hosted by a black radio DJ from Los Angeles.
That show quickly and quietly went away, but Clark eventually went on to build a huge television empire. He produced several successful game shows, the Emmys, Golden Globes, and the American Music Awards. And for three decades, he became a beloved constant in American living rooms as he counted down to the new year for millions from Times Square.
Here we go. The leap second will be accounted for in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year!
New Year's Eve won't ever be the same. Dick Clark died yesterday. He suffered a heart attack after undergoing a routine medical procedure. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Summer is coming, and with it, big summer movies with computer-created aliens, battles, and creatures. But not all filmmakers want to use CGI, and many of them attended a recent gathering called Monsterpalooza. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS was there, too, to talk with some monsters and their makers.
In 1931, Frankenstein's monster was reanimated on the screen, and a horror legend was born.
It's alive!
I'm awfully glad I didn't see him in those makeups. I would have probably been a damaged child.
That's Sarah Karloff. Her father, Boris Karloff, was the man who brought Mary Shelley's creature to vivid life.
Well, the makeup took almost 4 hours to put on every morning and 3 hours to take off every night.
That's the downside to creating monsters outside a computer. It takes a lot of time and work. But Monsterpalooza pays tribute to the artists and craftsmen who achieve movie magic through practical effects. That means creating the effect on the set and in camera. It could be the Frankenstein monster's elaborate makeup, or things like stop-motion animation, suit actors, puppets, or animatronics. On the convention floor, there are monsters everywhere. Some are in mid-transformation as makeup artists work their magic right before your eyes. There are also werewolves, zombies, and aliens wandering freely. You can also find humans, like actor Chris Sarandon.
The idea of being an actor and totally transforming yourself, and as we're talking, I'm just looking at a woman who's carrying what looks like a baby, but it's actually a little monster.
Sarandon was on a panel to discuss the 1985 film Fright Night, where he played a vampire.
Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
I don't think there's any doubt that there is more of a verisimilitude in the moment when you really look like the thing you're portraying rather than you're standing there with buttons all over your face so that the CGI people can go in and lay in the face later.
The late Stan Winston wasn't opposed to using CGI. He was always on the cutting edge of new technology and co-founded Digital Domain, a groundbreaking digital and visual effects studio. But his passion was for doing as much as possible live and on the set, says his son Matt Winston.
Acting is reacting. That's really what great acting is. And by giving an actor a live dinosaur on the set or a live zombie on the set, something that's right there in their face, no acting is required.
It's a dinosaur.
Winston now runs the Stan Winston School of Character Arts, which preserves and promotes the style of effects his dad made famous on films like Jurassic Park and Terminator. The practical approach is still attractive to young filmmakers. CGI may be able to create anything, but because it's not grounded in the real world and forced to obey the laws of physics, your brain doesn't always buy into it, says visual effects artist Christian Beckman.
You know, when you have a performer in a suit, that is the movement. That's your body. That's your, you know, anatomy. There's some CG characters that you're going to watch and they just don't have the right movement. And right away, you lose it.
Makeup effects are being celebrated in reality TV shows like Face Off that play like extended DVD bonus features, revealing the tricks of the trade. Makeup effects artist Frank Ippolito was featured on Face Off.
That's kind of helping to bring a little bit of a practical effects renaissance. I think it's great for the industry all around.
A renaissance fueled by the likes of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy and Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy films. These movies mix old and new technology to create fantastic worlds. Jackson's The Hobbit won't open until December. In the meantime, eager fans have been consoling themselves with behind-the-scenes glimpses of the Shire and all its strange and wonderful inhabitants, most of which will seamlessly blend practical effects with CGI. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.